This is the second episode in a three-part series on paving the way for ministry expansion, in which I unpack seven key moments in the life of Jesus. If you missed part one, why not take a moment and go back and listen to that episode just to get up to speed? Today, I'm talking about Jesus' pattern of stepping back to be with the Father, then stepping out into more fruitful ministry. Welcome to the Unhurried Living Podcast. I'm glad you've joined us again this week. As I've mentioned in the last couple of episodes, we'll be releasing this podcast every other week over the summer. Right now, Jim and I are focusing on a few writing and resource development projects that we're looking forward to sharing with you. In today's episode, which continues where I left off last episode, I begin to unpack a pattern in the Gospel of Luke that a friend of mine, Shinasami, first pointed out to me. Every moment of ministry expansion or development in the life of Jesus is preceded by and grows out of a significant moment of his stepping back to be alone with his Father. You'll see this as I talk about the first three of seven incidents of Jesus stepping back to be with the Father that are recorded in the Gospel of Luke. So without any more comment, here is part two of Paving the Way for Ministry Expansion. What I want to do is walk through what is essentially seven instances in the Gospel of Luke that highlight this rhythm in the life of Jesus. But what I am going to do is just go step at a time through some of these passages that, one, highlight the rhythm of prayer in the life of Jesus, and two, show how his ministry continues to develop out of these moments. So one of the things I'd like to say is this. Luke's descriptions of Jesus' retreats, that's the word my friend used, and I like it, his retreats into prayer, his going into lonely places to pray, disclosed one of Christ's motives for withdrawal. He sought solitude before times of transition. Jesus, aware of imminent changes in ministry, desired to be still, to listen to the Father's heart, to engage in prayer, and then to move into his changing ministry. See, what we've come to believe deeply because of our experience is that this rhythm of prayer and ministry is a very fruitful one when we get the rhythm right. Now, my temptation is for it to be a teeter-totter that goes one way or the other. And I can describe seasons where there was a lot of doing and a lot of work, which all of which I think God had given me to do, but prayer had grown a bit thin. And when that has happened, a few things have happened. One, I tend to do this work more anxiously. Or I tend to do this work with a little less gas in the tank. I get a little tired or a little quicker. Or there's a little less wisdom or a little less creativity or a little less vision, just because I've lost touch with the fact that this is all the work of God. So one of the things that's been helpful for me is to realize, and I use this image all through our weekend together, so forgive me for some of you, this is now the umpteenth time you're hearing this image. But as a biblical image for ministry, one of my very favorite metaphors Jesus uses is the metaphor of a yoke, right? And you can, I think, you can picture, right, the yoke with the two loops, and it's built for two animals, and in the middle of that cross beam, there's something that's going to hold a plow or something, a cart that's being pulled. Work is being done. Yoke is a work image, right? Except the irony is that when Jesus says to busy, burdened, heavy-hearted people, is anyone weary or heavy laden? Come to me, and I'll help you find rest. And then he says, take my yoke. Now that sounds odd to me, because if you were trying to give me a rest, I don't see why you'd be using a work image. How does that help me rest? And the way it helps me rest is genius. Because I believe that when Jesus is using that image of a yoke, he's saying at least two things, and probably many others. One, there's always two animals in a farmer's yoke. And I believe there are two persons in the yoke of life and ministry with Jesus. I'm there and Jesus is there. I'm not alone. The idea that God is with me is, it's not rocket science. Nobody around the table is going to say, God is with me? Shocking. I had no idea. We all know this. But one of the things I've realized the longer I go is I know a lot of things and I forget a lot of things. One of my big jobs is remembering what I know and holding on to it. Not just in the moments when it's easy to hold on to. Yeah, God's with me. I mean, when we're enjoying worship, you know, yesterday morning, and we are all together, and we are just cheering for God. That's easy to remember God's with us. You kidding me? Easy. Easy as pie. We're all together. We're all doing it. How about Tuesday about 11 o'clock? I don't know what time for you, but I'm just thinking that's one of the moments where I'm a little tired from the day so far. And the to-do list does not look like it got any shorter by 11. There are just moments, I'll be honest, when it's not as easy to remember God's with me right in the middle of this. Or something that really sucks happens. And that's a moment where you might be tempted to think, are you kidding me? How could God be with me in the middle of that? And the fact is, He is always with me, and that is always good news for me. Always. I mean, one of the challenges for me is not to end up with a professional relationship with this book only. I don't want to do that. I want to preach and teach well. I want to be deeply rooted in this book. But there is something about coming to this book regularly in a completely non-utilitarian way. On Saturday morning at the retreat center that we were all there, we had spent the morning in the first three verses of Isaiah 55. And then we had, I think, 2 hours, 90 minutes. Yeah. For me, I just sat at a window that was looking out over just the whole vista. Beautiful vision, the mountains in the background and the cactus everywhere. I just sat there and I rehearsed Isaiah 55, 1 for about an hour. Come, all you who are thirsty, come to the waters. And I felt like it was an invitation from God. I felt like God was saying, Alan, how are you thirsty these days? What does thirsty look like for you right now? Where are you dissatisfied? Where are you dry? Where do you feel more empty than full? What does thirsty look like for you? Come. Come to me. Come to the waters. I needed that. We've been in a very busy season. I felt a little overwhelmed by some of the things on my plate. And for that hour, I just got a new vision of, oh yeah, the training process, the curriculum, the weekly stuff we do over and over and over again. I'm not alone in that. God's very interested in it. God's more creative than I am. God is more wise than I am. So back to the yoke. Two things I love about the image of the yoke is one, I am never doing the work of ministry alone. I am in a yoke with Jesus. And two, like in any yoke, you probably know that there was always, often, there was an experienced animal and there was a newcomer. Didn't know how yokes work. Wasn't comfortable with the yokes. Wasn't accustomed to being in a yoke. And what would happen? The experienced, bigger, older, more mature animal would carry the heavy end in many ways and sort of train that other younger animal to be in the yoke with them, to gain experience. I'm never alone in ministry, and Jesus is always carrying the heavy end. That is good news for me. That's a good thing for me to remember. And what I find is that when I step back occasionally, in a way that I would argue is in the rhythm of Jesus, those are the moments when I remember. I remember that God is with me. I remember who God is. I remember that I'm in a yoke with Him, that I am not carrying the heavy end of it, that I am not alone in this work. So here are some of the texts in Luke that highlight this rhythm in the light of life of Jesus. The first is this line from Luke 4:42. At daybreak, Jesus went out to a solitary place. Now, it doesn't specifically say, and he prayed. But when you read the whole of the Gospel of Luke, it sort of becomes clear that this is one of the ways Luke's talking about Jesus stepping away from some of his normal places and patterns to be alone. Now, let me just say this. The practice of solitude is an invitation to anyone. Some of us are introverts. I happen to be one of those. Some of us are extroverts. Solitude turns out to be a discipline for both extroverts and introverts. It's a discipline for extroverts in maybe some obvious ways. Being alone is a little more challenging. You know, you're accustomed as an extrovert from drawing energy from interaction, and that's great. That's a gift from God. For introverts, solitude is a discipline because solitude is not just me time. Solitude isn't just privacy. Solitude isn't just going to my cave because I'm more comfortable there. All of those things I do as an introvert. Solitude is being alone with God. And as an introvert, the alone part might be comfortable, but sometimes the alone with God is a challenging discipline, not because God's hard to be with, but because I get distracted or I want to think about my own things instead of offering my attention to the God who's with me. For the extrovert, it's a challenge because being alone means you don't have the reference point, the energy source of those human interactions. My question always is when I'm with a group of leaders, was Jesus an introvert or an extrovert? I'm not sure you can make that assessment. I think you could find signs of Jesus enjoying things that introverts enjoy, and I think you can see Jesus enjoying things that extroverts enjoy. Jesus, at daybreak, went to a solitary place. And immediately following this text, immediately following Luke 4:42, Jesus' ministry expands outside the synagogue where just pretty much weekend by weekend he was preaching in the local synagogues in his immediate area, Nazareth and Capernaum, to be actual. And then he began to expand his ministry beyond that local neighborhood. That was a fruit of his stepping away to a solitary place. He begins to journey beyond his hometown. His ministry begins to expand. Nearly every expansion in our own ministry has come out of the fruit of getting away, stepping back, being alone with God. Decisive moments of transition, critical moments of new decision or new involvement have grown out of those moments. There's a second text. I've already mentioned it. It's the one that says, but Jesus often withdrew to lonely places to pray. Luke 5:15 is one of those many verses that talks about Jesus morning till night with the crowds coming, the need upon need upon need. And it's right in the midst of that busy that Jesus withdraws. You could say at that moment, the crowds are just loving Jesus. And I don't know if you've been in seasons where it just everything feels like Midas touch. It's just going great, and you're just really enjoying it. That turns out for me to be the seasons when it's hardest to withdraw. Because, I mean, heck, if you've got the Midas touch, all you want to do is touch stuff. And yet, I've found that the wisdom of Jesus often withdrawing to lonely places is long-term sustainable fruitfulness. Think about it. Often, not once or once upon a time or sometimes, Jesus did this often. To me, that argues for a rhythm. And he withdrew. Every time he withdrew, there was something he wasn't getting done. Inevitably, it will always be true. If we decide to follow Jesus in this rhythm of his life, there'll always be something. Because why is that true? Because ministry's never done. There is always something else you could do. It involves real people and real people's lives. And ministry is always there. And there'll always be something else you could do. And then it says, Jesus often withdrew to lonely places to pray. And this has been really helpful for me. What does that mean that he withdrew to lonely places to pray? What do I imagine that looking like if Jesus for an hour or two or three or a morning or whatever is praying? Sometimes I've imagined, gosh, I don't know if I've got 4 hours worth of things to say to God. That's a lot of praying. Maybe 20, 30 minutes I got stuff to say to God. 4 hours? I just think I'd be getting repetitious. And to me, this speaks to my own vision at times of what is prayer? And again, one of my mentors put it this way, and this, I have quoted this line hundreds of times over the last 30 years. And the line is simply this: prayer is not mainly something you do. Prayer is mainly someone you're with. Prayer is not mainly something you do. It's mainly someone you're with. So marriage isn't mainly something we do for 33 years. Marriage is mainly being with each other. Marriage isn't about a piece of paper in a file that got put in the file 33 some years ago. That's not our marriage. Marriage isn't words we said to each other in a church a little over 33 years ago. Marriage is someone we're with. That's what marriage is. Prayer is the same way. Prayer is being with God. After 33 years, there are times when we will be together for an hour and not say a word. And it's actually comfortable. It's okay. It's a sign of intimacy. We're relaxed. Sometimes prayer is just being in the presence of God. And God's so comfortable with you that he doesn't desperately need you to toss a monologue at him for 20 minutes or 30 minutes. Now, he is utterly interested in what is on your heart because he is the most remarkable father there is. He will listen to you for as long as you would like to talk. But he is also very pleased to just be in your presence. And some of the most meaningful moments of prayer for me have not been times where I was advising God on what I thought he should do about these 10 things that bothered me. You ever feel like that sometimes? I've looked at my prayers at times and thought, gosh, was this really the all-knowing, all-wise, all-caring God I was speaking to? Or the way I was talking to him, do I think he was like unaware and only semi-interested? Like I was trying to pique his interest in this stuff that bothers me. Instead of praying with a sense of, well, God, I know you already know this, and I already know you care more about this than I do, and you actually already know what to do about this, but it's bothering me. Would you act? Would you do something good here? That kind of a prayer sounds a little different than some of the sorts of prayers. And then being quiet in the presence of God with that in mind isn't necessarily an uncomfortable thing for us. Jesus often withdraws to lonely places to pray. And immediately after this, the ministry of Jesus enters into growing opposition with the Jewish leaders. This is the moment in the Gospel of Luke where the Jewish leaders start saying, uh-oh, this guy's going to be trouble. And in many ways, I think Jesus' rhythm of withdrawing helps him get ready to deal with what's going to be some very painful opposition. Opposition is no fun to deal with, is it? How are you going to do it well? Jesus does it well by withdrawing to lonely places to pray. Solitude strengthens our confidence because we remember, I am not facing this challenge or this opposition alone. Now we're in Luke chapter 6. Very famous. One of those days, Jesus went out to a mountainside to pray and spent the night praying to God. And then, immediately following this, Jesus formally calls and establishes his group of 12. And so solitude gave him wisdom and insight from the Father in making a critical choice. I mean, can you think of a more important choice Jesus had to make than to choose the 12 that he was going to entrust the entire ministry to? And have you ever thought about how Jesus chose some weird people? I don't know if I would have picked those 12. I mean, if I had a pile of resumes, boy, just being honest, I'm not sure I would have picked a tax collector. He is bad publicity for my movement. I mean, nobody likes him. Nobody likes him. Absolutely nobody. So why in the world does Jesus pick who he picks? I'd argue that because he spent the night praying, the Father had given him some insight. This one we want. This is one of the ones we want. He may seem an unlikely choice, but he's one of the ones we want. I mean, I love that about it because I was a very unlikely choice to become a pastor. I mean, my first introduction to Jesus was in a super fundamentalist church. I mean, just fundamentalism. Fundamentalists would have looked at this church and said, oh, they're so legalistic. Ugh. They managed to turn Psalm 139 into bad news. You know, it's supposed to say something like, even if I travel to the far side of the sea, even there your spirit will be with me. They translated that into something that sounded like this to my ears. No matter where you go, he will find you. I think I'm 8 or 9 years old. I don't know why my parents thought it was a good idea to drop me at this church, but this is what they did. I remember as an 8 or 9 year old, I decided there was a bush, a pyracantha bush in our backyard that was the one place I could safely hide from God. And I would frequently hide there somewhat shortly after this Sunday school experience. I mean, that was my vision of God. And there was nothing good that I was hearing about God growing up. Elementary, junior high, high school. High school was a mess, typical high school drinking and, you know, dating and all kinds of messy, dumb choices. And then this wild, crazy Jesus people guy became my boss at a car wash and started living Jesus in front of me. And I couldn't believe his life. I couldn't believe how much he loved me. He once told me about 10 years after we had first met, he said, of all the guys that worked for me, you were the last guy I thought would ever become a Christian. Isn't that a great joke? Because now I'm not just a Christian. I get to be a part of God's work in the world. God loves choosing surprising choices. Because, and we've heard all this, right? Biblically speaking, God's ways aren't our ways. God doesn't look on the outer appearance. God looks at the heart. God can see stuff we can't see. When we're picking leaders, often we go for Mr. High Personality and High Capability. And there's nothing wrong with those. Those are God-given things. But those aren't the only things God gives. I think of sometimes in ministry, I felt led to call somebody and they didn't strike me as like choice number one. I would have never put them behind a mic. So one of those days, Jesus went out to a mountainside to pray, and he spent the night praying to God. And after that, he chose his 12. So when we have big choices to make, leadership selection, for example, we could follow Jesus and say maybe the most important thing in preparation for a decision like that would be to just have some unhurried time in the presence of the Father, following the example of Jesus. But I would argue that this rhythm in the life of Jesus, where he withdraws to lonely places, or he goes away to a mountainside and spends the night praying, I think this is why he knew what the Father was saying, and he knew what the Father was doing. He had enough time to notice, to reflect on, to think about what the Father was saying and doing. Again, if we just say he knows what the Father is saying and doing because he's God, it's hard for that to feel helpful, since I'm not. I'm just a disciple. But if Jesus really does follow the Father in the power of the Spirit, then maybe how he lives is something I could follow. Again, thanks for joining us today. I hope you found this training helpful and that you'll join us in a couple of weeks as we share the final episode of this teaching on following the fruitful pattern of prayer and ministry in the life of Jesus. In addition to this podcast, you can receive weekly personal encouragement from us right in your email inbox. You can get on that list now by going to unhurriedliving.com/connect. We love connecting with more and more people who want to rest deeper, live fuller, and lead better.